Court will now call AVL Services, Inc. versus Tarrant Appraisal District and Review Board.
May I please the court, Mr. Jeffrey Levenger will argue for appellant, Mr. Robert Mott will argue for appellees.
Mr. Levenger.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. I think both parties agree that there's really only one issue in this case, and it's purely a legal one, and that is whether shipments of inventory to a federal enclave in Texas are transported outside of this state within the meaning of the Freeport exemption. The answer I submit is yes for a combination of three reasons. First is the legislature's use of the phrase outside of this state, which denotes a destination that denotes something that's more than just outside the geographic boundaries of the state. Second is the constitutional characteristics of a federal enclave. A federal enclave, of course, is created by deed of cession from the governor to a state. They're considered to be the legal equivalents of a sister state or foreign land in relation to the ceding state. And third is the purpose of the Freeport exemption, which is to promote economic development in Texas by attracting into Texas companies precisely like my client, AVL. Turning to the language of the Freeport exemption, the phrase outside of this state obviously includes destinations that are beyond the geographic boundaries of Texas. There can be no dispute about that. But it's not limited to such places. The word outside is broader than that. It includes places that do not belong to the state, do not connect with the state, and are beyond the limits of the state. And this would include places that are beyond the jurisdiction, the legislation, the sovereignty, or the control of the state of Texas, even if it's still within Texas's geographic boundaries. Notably, and I think this is very important, the legislature did not use the phrase outside the geographic boundaries of the state when it enacted the Freeport exemption. You will not find the words geographic boundaries or borders anywhere in the Freeport exemption. And we cannot read those words, of course, into the Constitution or the statute as the taxing entities would have you do. So how does the definition of outside apply to AVL shipments to the federal enclave at the Red River Army Depot? Well, I think the answer lies in the 1973 Supreme Court opinion in State Tax Commission of Mississippi. That case, State Tax Commission made 3 points about federal enclaves that I think control the outcome of this case. One is that federal enclaves are like federal islands that are no longer part of the ceding state nor function under its control. Number two is that they're the equivalent of a sister state or foreign land in relation to the ceding state. And the third point the case made is that shipments to a federal enclave are not into the state. They're not considered to be shipments into the state within the meaning of the 21st Amendment. So what's the lesson as it applies to our case from State Tax Commission of Mississippi? Well, I think it's this. If shipments to a federal enclave are not into the state within the meaning of the 21st Amendment, then the converse is that they're outside of the state within the meaning of the Freeport exemption. The case is really the mirror image, the flip side of our case. What controls in both cases, whether we're talking about the 21st Amendment or the Freeport exemption, what controls is the legal relationship between the federal enclave and the ceding state.
Well, it's your contention that the language in this statute is plain and unambiguous.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes.
But you have directed us to what I would consider arguably some legislative history, probably all that there is on it. Would it be appropriate, given your position, that the statute's plain for us to look beyond the statute?
Yes. I think it is, Justice Casey, for the reason that in the Dietz case, the Republic Party of Texas versus Dietz, the court made the comment that in ascertaining the meaning of a statute, or I think that case was constitutional provision, it's important to look not only at the words, but then the court went on to say, but also the historical context in which it's drafted, the purpose of it, and it listed a series of things that should be considered. So, yes, I think the answer is it is appropriate. But, of course, the starting point is always the literal text of the Constitution.
Of course, the history that you provided really doesn't help because they use the same terminology. And the other question I had was in the Legislative Council's analysis, they refer to, they say that almost every other state exempts, has these Freeport exemptions.
Right.
Have you searched all the other states?
We searched every state, and we could not find a single case.
Going either way.
Going either way.
Is the language that's used in the Texas statute similar to language that's used in other states? Did you look that deeply?
Well, we looked, and it was, I don't really know the answer to that because they just vary quite widely. We really couldn't find any other Freeport exemption that uses quite the same phrasing that Texas uses. And for that matter, we couldn't find any other Texas statute or constitutional provision that uses the phrase outside of the state or outside the geographic boundaries of the state. So I think, as I said at the very beginning of our brief, this is a case of first impression, and the court is really on new ground here. But we do have cases like Harmon from the San Antonio Court of Appeals and the USF&G case from Colorado, which said that persons living on a federal enclave are not residents within the state for purposes of non-resident service statutes. So again, these cases are sort of the flip side of our case. If you're not within the state, then you're necessarily outside of the state. Now, the taxing entities rely here, as they did below, on three Supreme Court cases, all of which predate state tax commission, and all of which I think are really inapposite to our case. The first case, surplus trading, I think actually helps our position because there the court said that when a federal enclave is created, the state surrenders sovereignty and it's no longer part of the state. That's what surplus trading held, and in that case they said that the federal army camp was a federal enclave and that the state could not tax army blankets on that federal enclave. The second case they cite, the Howard case, allowed a federal enclave to be annexed into a city and then allowed its residents to be taxed. I think there are two key facts in that case that distinguish it from ours. One is that the federal government never challenged the annexation, and two is that Congress had allowed the states to impose the tax via the Buck Act. So I think both those factors distinguish it. The third case is the Evans case, which is the voting rights case. There, the court held that the equal protection upheld the equal protection rights of people to vote, even though they were living on a federal enclave. They held that those people could vote in state elections. The result, I think, is not surprising. It was a strict scrutiny analysis, and it really turned on several factors unique to that case, that the people had been voting for about 15 years, even since the enclave had been created, that the people had been counted for purposes of the census and for purposes of congressional apportionment, and the people living on that enclave were affected by state laws, both off the enclave when they left and on the enclave as a result of Congress's authorization to the state to impose certain laws on the federal enclave. So I think the focus in that case was on the people. It had nothing to do with shipments into the federal enclave or the characterization of what those shipments are.
I have a couple of questions. It seems like your interpretation perhaps ignores some of the other words that are in the statute. For example, it uses the phrase, the property is detained in this state, and it also uses the word transported, which to me implies sort of a physical location and movement or the staying within the state. Do you have any cases that talk about that kind of language?
No, we don't have any cases that talk about those, but I would say that those words are still consistent with what we're saying because, you know, we don't deny that, and they don't contest that the property was acquired in Texas, and nobody denies that it was transported The question is, was it transported outside of the state?
Okay.
And that's what it boils down to for us. Outside of connotes something more than just geographically outside. It connotes something beyond the jurisdiction, beyond the sovereignty, beyond the legislation, or beyond the control of the state, even though it can still be located within the state. So you've got all the ingredients. It was detained, it was transported, and it was transported outside of the sovereignty, the jurisdiction of the state, as a result of going into the federal enclave.
And does the fact that the statute particularly alludes to and includes aircraft parts, does that work to your benefit or against you?
I think it works to our benefit because it really underscores the purpose of the Freeport exemption. That was the last point I wanted to make, that I think the purpose confirms that it was intended to apply to shipments to federal enclaves located in Texas. Remember, it was adopted in 1989, which was a time of great economic turmoil in Texas, and it was intended to promote economic development by attracting companies into Texas, especially companies like Aviol, which are in the business of distributing aircraft parts. It's, as you say, it's mentioned specifically in the Constitution. Mm-hmm. And Aviol located its distribution center, and the evidence on this is undisputed, in Irving in part because of the Freeport exemption. Remember, taxing jurisdictions can opt not to allow the Freeport exemption. It's an optional type exemption. These taxing entities did opt to have it, and that's in part why Aviol decided to locate there. And I think the purpose of the Freeport exemption would be undermined if shipments of aircraft parts to the Red River Army Depot were taxed, while shipments of aircraft parts for all intents and purposes, similar military installations outside the state, which have the same jurisdictional relationship to Texas, were not taxed. So I think we would have this anomaly that really undermines the purpose of the Freeport exemption, which was intended in part to attract companies like our client into the state of Texas.
I have another question, too. This might be outside the record and probably irrelevant to this, but it's a point of curiosity. I think this case involved only one particular tax year. Was there any evidence relative to either prior tax years that were contested?
No, there's not, Justice okay. Livingston, but there is a parallel case pending in Dallas County involving the Dallas taxing entity.
All right, thank you.
Which I think is for the same tax year, if I'm not mistaken.
All right, thank you.
Unless the court has any further questions, that would conclude my argument. Thank you.
All right. Mr. Mott?
Yes, Your Honor. May it please this honorable court. It's always good to appear before the Fort Worth Court of Appeals. We've dealt with many issues involving property taxation, the construction of the Texas Property Tax Code, and the Texas constitutional provisions applicable to taxation with you previously. And I want to begin by stating, frankly, here that this case is not about federal law. It is about state law. It is about whether the commonly understood meaning of state, of Texas, is accepted. And we, too, believe that the plain meaning of the words of the Constitution support our position, because anyone, the members of the legislature, I was there when the legislature passed this, heard the discussions, read it, because I was already working in the property tax field. There's no notion that anyone there expanded or looked upon the notion of inside or outside the state of Texas as anything other than the commonly understood meaning of that term. And although the idea was to promote commerce, and that was clearly what they were doing, there were a number of other changes to the Texas Constitution made in that same session. That was simply to allow that by adopting essentially a mirror provision for Texas as other states have provided, as you indicated earlier, Mr. Chief Justice. Virtually every state has a Freeport provision. This one is no different. The nuances are no different. And what they do essentially is expand upon the Commerce Clause exemption that the Supreme Court has allowed in the past. Now, this question is whether you will follow the commonly understood meaning of the state of Texas, or whether you will imply an expanded definition of outside the state, basically based upon a fiction that the federal courts, the Supreme Court has recognized as a fiction in one line of Supreme Court cases while ignoring the distinctions made in another line of United States Supreme Court cases, all of which, some of which involve taxation, cases on both sides, and involve much the same issue. Facts are important as well here, extremely important. This property tax was located in Irving, Texas, in Grapevine-Colleyville School District on January 1, 2006. And Justice Livingston, there is a companion 2007 case as well. This is not just limited to 1 year. It was subsequently sent to the Red River Depot within 175 days. The property was. Both this property and the owner received the benefits and protections of local government. The property is not located in the federal enclave or in the hands of the federal government on January 1. If so, it would be exempt. I've dealt with enclave taxation questions throughout my career all over the state of Texas. There is no question that property tax may not be imposed on property located within a federal enclave. That is not our question. Our question is whether property taxes may be imposed upon this property while it is in Texas and destined for a federal enclave within the state of Texas. 90% of the inventory of the appellant was exempted because it was shipped out of the state of Texas. This is one small sliver, approximately a little less, I believe, than 10% of the inventory of this particular property owner. The statutory and constitutional purpose of promoting economic development was served by the proper application of this law. Now, there is no federal question here at all. This is simply a diversion. The federal government is not a party. The federal government has not intervened, and its interests are not involved. It is not true, for example, that the fact that that tax may be passed along as cost to the federal government, that has never been an issue in any enclave case and is not present here. This is solely a question of the meaning of Article 8, Section 1J. And that particular provision, that language is very clear in what it lays out. The property is exempt from ad valorem taxation if the property is transported outside of this state not later than 175 days after the person acquired or imported the property in this state. And there is no suggestion anywhere, not in the legislative history, not anywhere, that anything other than the commonly understood meaning of the state of Texas was ever considered or implied, either by the legislators who drafted it or, above all, by the voters who adopted this amendment and supported it. Now, there is, I think we've cited in our brief pretty extensively some of the Texas cases that deal with the plainly understood and commonly understood meaning. On page 11 of our brief, we went through and citing Dietz, which was also cited by plaintiffs, citing the Stringer case. Under the plain meaning rule, it is if a provision is clear and unambiguous, resorting to extrinsic aids and rules of construction are inappropriate, and the provision should be given its common everyday meaning. You don't have to go to dictionaries. You don't have to go to separate sources. The state of Texas means the state of Texas as it means to each citizen. Now,
could you address the 1973 United States Supreme Court case, please, that
yes,
they rely
yes,
on?
Yes, ma'am. I would be glad to, Justice Gardner. That case dealt with, and keep in mind, this is a case that dealt with a conflict between two federal constitutional provisions, the one governing authorizing states to govern liquor that arose after the prohibition era, and the enclave provision here. And very important distinctions were made in the court. And I would characterize that case not as the way plaintiffs do, as reviving an old fiction. This state within a state thing had been thrown around before. This court simply quoted the district court in reciting that again. But the issues here are, and I think it's very important to recognize what the court said that in their holding. And this was on page 377, I believe, and it's on page 13 of the copy of the case attached to our brief under tab 5. This is not to suggest that the state is without authority to either to regulate liquor shipments destined for the bases while such shipments are passing through Mississippi or to regulate the transportation of liquor off the bases and into Mississippi for consumption there. A state may, in the absence of conflicting federal regulation, properly exercise its police powers to regulate and control such shipments during their passage through the territory. It's important to note that there is a balancing act in all of these decisions and included in the Mississippi case. If federal interests are implicated, then the exclusive nature of the enclave jurisdiction of the federal government is invoked. If federal interests are not implicated, it is not. That was perhaps made even clearer in the case that we cited, being the case of Howard versus Commissioner's Sinking Fund in the city of Louisville, also a taxation case. And in this case, I would note, and this was on page 5, as is in ours, and this is a portion of what was highlighted. The fiction of a state within a state can have no validity to prevent the state from exercising its power over the federal area within its boundaries so long as there is no interference with the jurisdiction asserted by the federal government. The sovereign rights in this dual relationship are not antagonistic. Accommodation and cooperation are their aim. It is friction, not fiction, to which we must give heed. There is no conflict here. Both of these cases actually deal with the same issues and using the same balancing act that the federal courts have always utilized in applying the doctrine of the United States constitutional issues with respect to federal enclaves. If there is no conflict with federal interest, then the state may regulate, the state may tax, unless the federal government has prohibited them from doing so. The federal government has not prohibited this tax in any way, shape, form, or fashion. The United States is not a party to this case. What is more, this case does not in any way affect the interest of the United States. It really affects the interest of the Grapevine-Colleyville Independent School District and the other entities that provide service to these folks, and of course to the other taxpayers within, by providing, as appellants would suggest, an exemption that was not contemplated by the Texas legislature in any way whatsoever when they formulated this constitutional amendment. So I would, when you read the cases and you read all of these cases, you find in fact that they, in each case, perform a balancing act. They look to the conflict of interest in the United States, and since this is a very important part of our nation's defense, these bases, if anything here conflicted with the interest of the United States, we wouldn't be here. It does not. So both the Mississippi case and the other cases that we have cited, the Howard case in particular, clearly state this. And Howard, I think, correctly characterizes with this for what it is. What appellants are asking is that you read something into the Texas Constitution, that you ignore what Texas citizens would consider to be the plain meaning of the state of Texas, its geographical boundaries. They don't need to read that into a constitutional amendment. It's not necessary, because that's what people recognize. When they say the state of Texas, you know, unless they're being elaborate and talking about Texas's state of mind or something silly like that, they mean the geographical boundaries of the state of Texas. This is the well-known and commonly accepted meaning, and it's what the Texas legislature intended here. Now, also we cited Evans versus Gorman, which again followed Howard in the voting rights case. This was a 1970 case, 3 years before the Mississippi decision, and the court went through, rejects the state within the state fiction, clearly holds that individual living with an enclave still live within the state and are still citizens, entitled to the rights of citizens of that state. So this fiction that exists is merely that. There is no state within the state, and as a matter of fact, in our brief, I think we noted that the United States Constitution forbids that. It is a legal fiction used to justify federal supremacy, which we acknowledge, we have no problem with, within an enclave, federal jurisdiction is supreme. If the United States was concerned about this, if they felt that they were affected, they would reverse the longstanding rule that taxation of things destined for an enclave impugned the interest of the United States and would forbid such. But they have not done so, not ever, because they don't. They don't affect it at all. Now, there are a couple of other cases that may show up in final argument, but that were cited, I think, in footnote in plaintiff's brief and came back in their reply brief. One was United States versus McGee, a 1983 Sixth Circuit case in which the attempted annexation by the city of Dayton, basically of a portion of an enclave, was actually prohibited, unlike in the Howard case where the court allowed it. And there were some important distinctions. One, the federal government opposed it. And, in fact, it was distinguished on that basis. But it was distinguished on another very important basis that reflects the balancing act that federal courts perform in applying the enclave clause of the United States Constitution. And that was, the court said, there's a difference here. The potential for friction is greater because this was an attempted annexation by a city of a key military base, not just a supply depot. By the way, this is about the Red River Depot. And not an ordnance plant, which is all that they had there. So they note that it is, in fact, friction that comes into play. It is, in fact, only true that you consider an enclave not to be a part of the state whenever state interest and federal interest conflict. And, in fact, it's not really considered not part of the state. It's simply that we all recognize that the United States Constitution is the Supreme Court of this land, and it does apply in these circumstances, and it states that these enclaves have jurisdiction that's exclusive, except as the agreement may otherwise provide.
Counsel, one of the principal cases that the appellants rely on is that State Tax Commission Mississippi case.
Yes, sir.
And you address it in your brief. The only distinction that you make between it and our case, factually anyway, is that it was an inverse situation, essentially. I mean, what? That seems to be superficial to me.
It does. In that regard, let me explain the difference this way. In that case, the facts were that that liquor was being shipped directly to federal facilities for consumption by United States soldiers on base. It was shipped to the federal government for that purpose in that circumstance. Now, in our case, we have the private interest of property located at. They were attempting to tax it, the income arising from that liquor transaction, to force an add-on to an expense that would be measured by the sale on that particular base. Now, that is a very different type of circumstance than we have here.
But did the court rest its decision on that kind of distinction and circumstance? It didn't seem to me, when I read the copy of the case, that the court focused on any kind of interference or conflict, such as you were talking about a while ago, but more on the language used, that it was not coming into the state.
Exactly. That it came, in fact, it came in that circumstance from outside the state, literally directly to the enclave in that circumstance, and they made that distinction. But there was a distinction there that the court found a conflict between federal interest and state interest. That is not present in our case. There is no conflict. There is none whatsoever. The United States government is not a part of this case. And I think that that's extraordinarily important. Texas means
Mr.
all
Mott,
of
I'm
Texas.
Sorry, but we've yes. taken you over your time. And
oh, okay. Yes, Your Honor. Yeah. Thank you.
Mr. Levenger?
Well, I think State Tax Commission is absolutely controlling here. The question in that case was whether shipments to a federal enclave were into the state. And there were actually four types of military installations in that case, four different ones. Two were federal enclaves and two were not. They were concurrent jurisdiction facilities. As to the two federal enclave facilities, the court held that the shipments were not into the state. Why not? Because the federal enclaves were considered to be the equivalent of sister states or foreign lands in relation to the ceding state. They were not part of the state. As to the concurrent jurisdiction facilities, though, the court said those shipments were into the state. Why? Because the current concurrent jurisdiction facilities didn't involve that cession of exclusive jurisdiction. So the absolute key to that case was the federal enclave attributes, constitutional attributes. I think counsel raises a series of false issues about what we're contending and not contending. We're not saying that this is a state within a state. We're not arguing that, and our argument doesn't depend on that. We're not saying that there's any interference with the federal government, and our argument doesn't depend on that. Nor, for that matter, did the argument in State Tax Commission of Mississippi. That really is the controlling case here. I think if anybody's reading something into the statute, it's the taxing entities. They're reading into the statute or the Constitution the words geographic, boundaries, borders, or the like. We're just relying on the literal wording outside of this state.
But for someone informing the taxing authorities of the federal case law giving special treatment to federal enclave, don't you think it'd be reasonable for anyone to read it the way that, you know, geographical limits is outside the state if you're outside the geographical limits? I mean, it's a reasonable interpretation of the language of the statute, is it not?
Well, I don't think so, because when the legislature enacted the Constitution and the statute in 1989, they're charged with knowledge of the case law. I think there's some case law that says that. They're charged with knowledge of what's out there. And I think you need to look at the historical context in which it was enacted. By the way,
But that's a different question than what I just asked, which is, isn't it reasonable to interpret the statute as meaning outside the geographical limits? It's certainly, you may not consider me to be a reasonable person, but it seemed reasonable to me but for the information that I gained from the briefs regarding federal enclaves.
Well, certainly the wording would include places outside the geography of outside the geographic boundaries of Texas. Yeah. There's no question about that. My point is it's not limited to that. And when the legislature enacted the Constitution and the statute, they were charged with knowledge of State Tax Commission of Mississippi in 1973. They were charged with knowledge of the Attorney General opinion in 1981. They were charged with knowledge of the Harmon opinion in 1941, all saying that federal enclaves do not belong to the state.
Is this the only legislative history that is out there that you're aware of?
Yes.
I assume it is, because you would have provided something more.
That's all we're aware of, yes.
There's no committee discussions that were recorded or anything
not,
of that nature?
Not that we know of. And, in fact, I think the 1989 amendment was in response to a Dallas Court of Appeals opinion that had suggested that a statutory Freeport exemption might be unconstitutional. So they went to the populace with the constitutional amendment in 1989. But at that time, they were charged with knowledge of all the attributes of federal enclaves that I've said, including that they're the legal equivalent of a sister state or foreign land in relation to the ceding state. And when you put that within the rubric of the constitutional and statutory language, I think it can lead to only one conclusion, and that is that the exemption does, in fact, apply here to shipments, not to concurrent jurisdiction facilities or things like that, but to federal enclaves. It's a very narrow holding, but I think it's one that's warranted by the language. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Levenger and Mr. Mott and your co-counsel. Arguments were very well done. We appreciate all of you appearing here this morning to present them, and been very helpful. Case is submitted, and we're going to recess for a panel change, and we'll come back in about 10 minutes, take up the third case. Thank you.